Welcome to selfdiscoverymedia.com, where we discover the communities that are making a difference in the lives of others. Our self-discovery is something we are all making on our life's journey. Here you will find the people that will be your guidance, that will be your inspiration, that will be there for you in support on your journey of life. Do enjoy. Our next show is... Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Their Story Matters, right here on selfdiscoverymedia.com. I'm your host, Sarah Troy. My wonderful guest is Jared Knott. He's written an exceptional book that really is truly fascinating. Big Disasters, Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters. The what if factor. What if they hadn't done that? What if they'd only done that? Things would have been completely and utterly different in history. He says the small things had great historical consequences, and that often it doesn't happen as a single tiny mistake. It can cause an entire civilization to collapse. One tiny mistake, more often than you think. Readers of the Knott's book, Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters, will be amazed at the little things that have changed history in a big way. Here are a few examples. A single document poorly designed by one single clerk in one single country changed the outcome of the presidential election and led to a direct major war. A soldier accidentally kicks a helmet off the top of the wall and causes an entire empire to collapse. And a small mechanical device several inches long fails to function, which changes the outcome of World War II and leads to the death of millions of people. Oh my goodness, all these tiny blunders. What I'm absolutely fascinated to know, though, is how did you gather all this information? Welcome to the show, Jared.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here. It's an honor. Yes, over the years, I've read, because I'm sure you are a reader, avid reader, and I remember things from 30, 40, 50 years ago. I tell people my mind is a trash bin of trivia.
You should be on Trivial Pursuit.
Yeah, I got the idea for the book about 11 years ago with one or two ideas. It comes from the old adage from Benjamin Franklin. From one of a nail, the shoe was lost. From one of a shoe, the rider was lost. From one of the rider, the battle was lost. From one of the battle, the empire was lost. The empire was lost, all for the want of a nail. But how often does that really happen? It's a nice saying, but how often does it really happen that a single tiny mistake caused an empire to collapse? About 39 times, but actually it's a lot more often than that. 39 is a rhetorical number. The actual number of stories in the book is more like 45, or depending on how you slice it, almost.
Sorry, love, I've lost you.
Can you hear me?
Oh, now I can't. Yep, you lost you for a moment.
Yeah, it's amazing how often a single tiny mistake can cause an entire empire to collapse and fall apart.
Yes. Oh, for hindsight, right? If only I hadn't, or if only I had, which we can all apply to our own lives, right? Because hindsight is 20/20. But, you know, when you think about the kind of the chess game of war or decision making or anything that goes into anything, really, you need 100 eyes on the situation from all angles to see things from all angles of but what if this happens, or what if that happens, what's the contingency plan? And very often it is that tiny weeny mistake that has the repercussions. You know, my brother wrote a book, The Repercussions of Thomas D, and it's about a youth on his cell phone who walks from wormhole while talking to his girlfriend and ends up in World War II and accidentally gives the entire future away to a German spy.
I see.
Well, which changed the entire outcome.
Yeah, but, I bet it would, yes. Because we don't have magic time machines, fortunately or unfortunately.
Right, exactly. But, the synopsis of that is that how little things can change. Mm. And I think, you know, it's not just a question of people being overconfident, right? As you said, you know, one soldier, helmet, going off at the wrong time, and then because everybody's on edge, everybody's trigger happy, everybody's ready to go, right? And it's the false start, and it's like very often it's just simply not preventable, is it?
Yeah, sometimes at the time these tiny mistakes are happening, the individual almost never realized how important it is. It seemed like a very, very minor thing. And yet it dominoes and multiplies and yes. throws against something else and boom, 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 boom. And then here comes this huge, huge, huge disaster in war or in politics or in navigation. But let's see, would you like an example?
I would love lots of examples, please, because this is intriguing.
Yes, I'll start with a modern day one. This teaser there is, as you mentioned, a single document poorly designed by one single clerk in one single county changed the outcome of a presidential election directly to a major war. And the war would not have taken place except for this single tiny mistake. Mm. But it has to do with the presidential election in 2000 down in Florida. And it's not the Hanging Chads. Most people are familiar with or heard about the Hanging Chads. It's not that at all. It was something completely different. A nice lady who was the collector, who was the clerk of elections in Palm Beach County, was designing a ballot that with large print so that people, the older people, could read it easily. Okay. And she designed it on two different pages, a left page and a right page, with punch holes down the center. They call it the butterfly ballot, like the two wings of a butterfly. Al Gore was the number two name on the left page, but he was the number three punch hole on the punch hole list. The number two punch hole belonged to Pat Buchanan on the other side of the page. Well, it was very confusing the way it was designed. It had little arrows there, but the people missed that. And so some people would punch both punch holes and realize they made a mistake and punch both punch holes, which invalidated the ballot. But Pat Buchanan in the surrounding counties, he got maybe 150 votes per county. In this particular county, he gets over like 4,000 votes. And he himself said, well, it was an obvious mistake, people punching the wrong punch hole. So Al Gore lost the state of Florida in 2000 by just 456 votes. He would have won by 5,000 votes or more. He lost Florida. He lost the presidential election. He would have won the presidential election. He would have been president of the United States. And he was adamantly opposed to the war in Iraq. Right. The war in Iraq cost us 50,000 lives and $2 trillion. And they had this nice lady. She's now, by the way, let me say, all of us have made mistakes, this big or worse. Her mistake just happened to come right at the critical time.
Right.
In the first place. So they had the nice lady on the morning talk show, and they were saying to her, people say that you're responsible for this war. And she was in tears and she was crying.
God.
Boo-hoo, boo-hoo. Well, I appreciate the fact that you're crying, but we have 50,000 dead people and $2 trillion all down the drain, all because of a single tiny mistake.
Yeah, but come on, folks, put that on her shoulders. How cruel and unnecessary, right?
Yeah, the people making the decision to go to war in the first place. Now,
exactly.
Now the 9/11 Commission said that decision to go to war was an example of groupthink, and it's now regarded as a major mistake. But of course, again, we don't have that magic time machine
to go back
and change things. And yes, of course, the leaders making the decision take the primary responsibility for the consequences of the war.
Mm. It's also kind of, you know, there's always the scapegoat, isn't there? Anytime you see a mistake, you know, nobody wants to own it, and they're going to pick somebody to be a scapegoat. And you can just imagine the burden on that poor woman's shoulders of, you know, 50,000, you know, lives on her shoulders, which was who was overchecking her printing? Because obviously she designed it, but as you said, the butterfly effect and this and that, when the fold, you know, it got confusing. When they did that, why didn't they check it then and go, hang on, this isn't going to work? So, you know,
yes. From her perspective, seeing it from her, she understood it perfectly, of course, from her perspective, but she did not put herself in the shoes of the people seeing it for the first time. You have just a few seconds, half a minute, whatever, to make your decision. And she did not realize that it was confusing to people seeing it for the first time. You see what I'm saying? So that was the key thing there. And touching on what you said before, of course, there's the old saying that victory has 1,000 fathers and failure is an orphan.
Yes.
It's also another saying from the army that I use a different word, but that manure rolls downhill. So whenever they're looking for somebody to blame, it doesn't usually go up.
Usually
down. And what you got to do if you're, I was a young lieutenant in the ward, the first lieutenant. And so, you know, if a colonel or a general were to say, I did not have a particular situation like this, but if they say such and such is your fault, well, you got to argue with the colonel.
Right. I mean, the moral of that story is get out of the way.
Yes, try to be.
Rolling.
And also, one good thing, and which has been an important thing to pass on, especially to young people and everybody, I talked about the importance of covering your rear end in paper. If you have a good memo it covers all the details. It's hard to deny if you got all the facts in there that you did not do such and such, because here it is in writing. It had been several times in my career, and probably your career, where having something in writing was very, very helpful when it came to that manure starting to be thrown around kind of thing.
Right. Well, nowadays, of course, we've got the phone recorded.
That's right.
So, the other thing is document what's going on. So the manure can pass you on by. Right?
That's right. That river of manure flows to somebody else and not you. Yes.
Yes, exactly. You've got one here about Hitler. And could you imagine how different it would have been had he been successful in taking Hitler out? And, you know, but for what was really the mistake that caused that not to happen?
Yes, there's funny. We're talking about the tiny mechanical device failing to function at a critical time. That had to do, and it touches on your subject, your question there, that had to do with the German generals' assassination plots and attempts to eliminate Hitler, especially as the war was going badly. That received a lot of impetus and a lot of energy behind it. But at one point, it kept getting frustrating because Hitler, evil that he was, did have some shrewd common sense. And he said the reason that assassinations have been successful throughout the world so many times is that the assassins know the exact time and place where the target is going to be. Well, he deliberately, therefore, kept a very erratic schedule. No one knew where he was going to be, when he was going to be. He was supposed to show up at a meeting, be there for 30 seconds and walk out the door, et cetera, et cetera. But there was almost like one article about this, almost like there was an evil force protecting him, because time and time again, he just barely missed death. And this was talking about the tiny device. It has to do with one of those attempts on his life. He was encouraged by the German generals who were involved in the plot to visit Russia, okay, to review the plans, to review the strategy in the middle of the Russian war between Germany and Russia, of course. And when he got on his plane with all of his entourage to leave, they gave a box that supposedly had a bottle of liquor in it as a gift for a general back in Berlin. Here, take this box to so-and-so general such-and-such back in Berlin. Well, it was not a bottle of liquor at all. It was a bomb. And there was a device there about 3.5-4 inches long, which was a detonating device. So they pulled the trigger. Acid was supposed to eat through a particular chamber, which would lead to the firing of the device and so on. So they put it on the plane. Plane takes off. 45 minutes later, it's going to explode. An hour passes, 2 hour passes, 3 hour passes. Hitler's plane lands in Berlin without incident. Oh my gosh. Now they got this box there that has a bomb in it. If somebody opens it up and looks inside and sees that it's a bomb, they're going to be in big trouble. So they've managed to get to the box in Berlin. They managed to get a hold of it again and bring it back. And the device failed to function. It somehow, the acid had eaten through, but somehow the firing pin did not fire. And if it had fired then the Germans generals would have taken over, been able to take over. They could have surrendered to the British and to the Americans about a year earlier than when the war actually ended. Hundreds of thousands of lives would have been saved. The map of Europe would have been different. East Germany would have remained part of Germany, would not have been taken over by the Russians. Also part of Poland would not have been taken over, et cetera, et cetera. You would have had a very, very different outcome. So there we are.
Would you say, because I'm always a believer that, you know, things happen for a reason, and maybe things don't happen for a reason as well, that ideally, looking back in history, taking him out would have been a great idea. End the war, change the way history would have been. But do you feel that sometimes there is that kind of intervention of like a higher force saying, no, not yet, not this way. There's still a lesson to be learned from it.
Yes, there's Presbyterians believe in predestination, that everything is locked in place by the Lord, and that we don't really have free will. That's, of course, a huge, huge metaphysical discussion, whether we do or not. There was, by the way, it's interesting, there was an Operation Foxley in which they had parachuted marksmen into Germany, and they knew that Hitler was taking a walk there at Burgess Garden a certain time, and the idea was the sharpshooters were going to take him out. But the decision was made that he was making so many mistakes that he was better off staying in place than having the Germans take over. Now, the case with the German generals and their assassination plot, they had a system in place to take over the government when Hitler was killed. So it was not going to be a question of certain wrong generals taking over, the right general is going to take over and take over the government and then bring peace about. But in the case of an individual assassin, he was just shot, and the generals, Goering and the other generals, might have taken over, and they might have been much more difficult to outsmart than was Hitler. I'll give you, on that connection, I'll give you one of my favorite examples from the war about how the war, even late in 1944, possibly could have been won except for a mistake, an emotional decision by Hitler. And that had to do, it's kind of interesting, I'll start this way, start with this anecdote. General Eisenhower was driving through Plymouth in about 1943 or 44, and in the car with him, the Jeep with him, was his son, who had just graduated from West Point. And there was huge, huge amounts of supplies, gasoline, tanks, trucks, soldiers, logistical supplies, all concentrated in that one area. Plymouth and then Weymouth and some of the others were primarily Plymouth. And young John was saying, young second lieutenant said, well, gee, Dad, gosh, it's a good thing we have control of the air, or the Germans would be able to cause massive, massive damage with all the supplies concentrated in one place. And somewhat irritably, General Eisenhower said, if we did not have control of the air, I would not have allowed this concentration to take place. But he was thinking about regular air power, bombers and fighter bombers. He knew nothing about the V-1s and the V-2s, about the rockets. V-2, of course, being a supersonic rocket, and the V-1 being a buzz bomb. Well, after the war, and the bombs began dropping on London about a week after the invasion began. Well, after the war was all over, Eisenhower said that if the V-1s and V-2s had been directed at Plymouth and destroyed all that gasoline and all those trucks and all those tanks and all those men, all those supplies, the invasion would have to have been postponed. And since the invasion had begun a week before the bombs began falling, it might have meant that the invasion would have collapsed and failed from lack of support, from lack of all the materials that were necessary for the invasion. Well, then the Germans could have taken the troops from the Western Front, brought them to the Eastern Front. They could have taken the V-1s and V-2s, concentrated them on the Russians. They could have continued to develop. They already had their jet. The Russians had no jet, and they might very well have been able to stabilize a defensive line against the Russians on the Eastern Front. But of course, then another if, of course, we have the atomic bomb in the pipeline. Instead of it being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it might have been dropped on Munich and Berlin, and so all kinds of what ifs that would have taken place there. But that was a major mistake, an emotional mistake on Hitler's part. He wanted vengeance. He wanted to kill, drop bombs on London and kill school children and grandmothers and blow up school buses and so on and so forth, like vengeance. The military consideration was not in his thinking the way it should have been. So we're lucky he was a little bit crazy.
Oh, yeah, my mom was actually in London at that time, and she had my sister, and she said that she was on the way to the school one day to pick up some kids from the school, and one of those silent ones came over and just landed. And the kids were running, and she just kind of hid kids underneath the pram and threw herself over the pram. And, you know, just the amount of death around there, and the last minute sirens, because you literally had seconds, you know, before they saw them, because they didn't hear them. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you wake up in the morning and, or you come out of the bomb, that house is gone. Your house might be still standing. And she lived right the way through that. And it was kind of quite horrific. So it was almost like dirty play, you know, the silent ones, because nobody had a chance to defend themselves. And it was, you know, heading for the civilians.
Hmm. Yeah, thousands and thousands of children, of ladies, of non-combatants were killed, which was a sacrifice. But we're lucky that sacrifice was made. It was very, very wicked, evil, unstable man. So,
yeah.
In fact, on that subject, there was the foreign minister, the German foreign minister, von Ribbentrop, was saying that whenever he was making a proposal to Hitler, he discovered that the most extreme proposal was the one that the Führer liked the best. Okay, and that he was always criticized the generals for being too moderate and too limited. He said, Ribbentrop, he understands me. He's always going for these extreme measures, extreme proposals, and which pleased Hitler. Which, oh my gosh, which is the reason that we had such a gigantic mess from such an evil man.
Yeah.
In the first place.
Yes, exactly. Do you have anything on the Kennedy assassination, either one of them?
No, not on the assassination itself. I personally believe that it was the act of one soul unbalanced assassin. Back then, the security was far, far too loose. Mm-hmm. They were driving through the middle of Dallas, and the Secret Service looked up at all those windows and all those buildings, and they knew that was an opportunity for a rifleman to, and driving an open car, a rifleman to strike the, and the car was moving very slowly. They knew that was a weak point as a vulnerability. But back then, the standards were so loose that there was just allowed to take place. Now the security is far, far, far tighter. That would never be allowed to happen. And we just can't have our leaders, unfortunately, exposed to that kind of danger.
Yeah. What's been the most bizarre finding that you have found? You're like, you know, oh my God, how could this even happen? It's so ridiculous.
Well, yes, it's funny. There's lots of bizarre ones. There's one that is very interesting. It's a little bit long, so I'm not going to go into it, but China could have been a democracy, except for a mistake by Woodrow Wilson and the world leaders at the Versailles Treaty. Okay. We have a couple of minutes. I can tell.
Yes. I'm intrigued.
Yes.
Changing the entire front of how China would have been. Yes.
Well, it has to do. The title of the chapter is the missing paragraph that caused a war, but actually it caused much more than just one war. It's one of the biggest mistakes in the book. So, of course, World War War is won by the Allies. They're meeting there in Versailles to decide how to divide the spoils. And Japan had been on the side of the Allies and had defeated the Germans in the Pacific and had taken possession of the German concessions in China, areas of China that were controlled by the Germans. Okay. Well, the Chinese themselves had provided over 100,000 workers to the Allies. They had dug trenches and they were very valuable as well. So the both sides, Chinese and Germans, were entitled, Chinese and the Japanese were entitled, I think, to a certain amount of the spoils being divided. But there was a complication there. The Japanese wanted two things. They wanted to be able to control the concessions there in China that had been belonged to the Germans. And also they wanted a simple thing. They wanted a statement of human equality to be put in the Versailles Treaty. Well, gosh, you could quote actually from the, excuse me, sir. You could quote, that was my wife. No, thank you. I'm busy. Yeah, sorry about that.
Okay. That's okay.
You could quote from, that happened to Rudolph Giuliani once in a debate. The telephone rang right in the middle. I think it was his wife. But anyway, So they all wanted their concessions. Now, the Japanese wanted just a simple statement, two paragraphs, one paragraph, a sentence, that all human beings in the world should be treated with equal rights and with equal respect, et cetera, et cetera. Again, go to the Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal.
Okay.
Well, what was the problem? Well, down in Australia, even to this day, thinks of themselves as a white island floating in an Asian sea. They do not want a lot of Asians coming in, working for cheap labor and take the labor wages away from Australian workers. Also on the West Coast at that time, there was a similar attitude, Asians coming in, taking wages away, jobs away from the native and inhabitants there. So both the senators from the Western United States and a very irascible man, who was the prime minister of Australia, Billy Hughes, okay, and he and Woodrow Wilson butted heads from the very beginning, and Wilson refers to him as a pestiferous varmint, okay,
and
very difficult to get along with. They say he had some kind of bowel irritation, Billy Hughes did, and he was made a very difficult man to get along with. Anyway, so they were opposed, the senators and Billy Hughes opposed to that one paragraph in the Versailles Treaty. You look back now, what in the world?
How did we oppose that?
What in the world? So they appeased Billy Hughes, and he needed the votes of the senators from Western United States to get his League of Nations verified by the Senate. So he caved in to those two forces, and they did not
frozen for a moment.
Provide that one paragraph to the Japanese, but as a sop to them. The guy is a sop. They said, well, okay, we can't give you one paragraph, but we can give you the concessions there, the German concessions in China. It's kind of, we can't give you the apple, but we can give you the banana. Okay, so and so this was announced. And by the way, Wilson's 14 points, and people had great admiration for Woodrow Wilson. His 14 points included a point that people should be able to determine their own government. They should not have governments imposed on them from outside forces, from colonies from the outside. That was one of the major points there. Well, this was a complete violation of that point, giving the German concessions to the Japanese. Now they could go into those concessions and they would be in charge of a particular part of China. Well, that whole decision was announced on, the dates are important, May 3rd. On the now infamous May 4th, demonstrations break out all across China. And one of the Chinese leaders had said, we had believed in Woodrow Wilson and the Western democracies, and then we decided that they were all great liars. Mm. So they turned away for the Western democracies, they turned to a new philosophy coming out of Russia at that time called communism. Okay, and the May 4th movement, which came out of that announcement, turned into the communist movement, included Mao Zedong, who took over and led the nation in the direction of communism. Well, if they just had that one damn paragraph.
I mean, we're looking at right now with what's going on with China. You know, it is the next great force. And it's very subtle. Like, it's buying up Africa, it's buying up here, buying up there. You know, if we don't pay attention, you know, it's, the domination is there. Now, you imagine if that one paragraph had been there.
Yes. That's covered,
the whole world would have been different.
Yes. My source on that is Professor McMillan on the book, best-selling book for 1919. And it's well documented, is that one tiny mistake and one little paragraph could have changed everything. Yes. Can you imagine if China were a democracy today? India's a democracy, Japan's a democracy, South Korea's a democracy. Can you imagine if China were a democracy, half of our problems might disappear. There would have been no COVID, there would have been no Korean War, there'd have been no Vietnam War, et cetera, et cetera. So, but again, we don't have that badly needed magic time machine to go back and change things.
But what do we learn from it, though? I mean, that one paragraph could have changed entirely the way, you know, we should live. Because that one paragraph, that one statement, we're all equal. You know, we all have a right to live, to be respected and to be treated well. Basically, that was fundamentally it. And that really should be the common code of conduct of humanity. And in all religions, it's there of treating each other with that respect. What happened to us as a humanity? You know, that A, we would repel a paragraph like that, and that we don't learn from it. Because yes, hindsight is 2020, but surely if we look back and we go, only that one paragraph, this and this and this one had happened, but yet we still seem to put the foot to the pedal of going down the wrong direction. You know, so do we invite these stupid mistakes as a human being? Well, are we so slow to learn?
Yes, I have a theory on that, and that is, which is sort of a rhetorical theory, so somewhat tongue-in-cheek, and that is that the human race is about 45% bad and 55% good. And that's why progress is so slow, because the evil forces are just almost is more powerful than the good forces. And all parts of the world, I mean, we, of course, here in the United States and in Canada, England, we have a democracy, we have freedom. In many, many parts of the world, that is not the case. The Chinese, of course, are persecuting, I should say, the minorities over there, the Muslim minorities, putting concentration camps, put to death. Russia, there's a huge amount of repression. In Africa, God bless the people. In Africa, God bless the people. In Mexico, our neighbor, the drug cartels have taken over large parts of the government. The justice system has been in collapse for a number of years. The United States, we take it, Canada, if you take it for granted, we can walk down the street, go to the grocery store, buy a gallon of milk and a loaf of bread, and walk back, and it's reasonably safe. Yeah. But of course, in some parts of our city, not so, United States, not so safe. But throughout the world, there are many, many cases where there's no law, and there's no protection, and life can be nightmarish. Yes. So hopefully.
So humanity. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think having a book like you have of like those tiny blunders, big mistakes, you know, it's the thing about it is by reading it is, yes, oh my goodness, really? What? You know, and all of that, there's the intrigue factor. But I think the lesson learned, you know, the lesson learned from it, you know, how life could have been so different. And perhaps, you know, the pandemic was that invitation to change things around because it flattened everybody in the world, and it's going on and on and on, and it's still going to go on for a while because we're too thick to learn. And it's about us as a humanity coming back together, going back to that one paragraph. treating each other as equal. And why are we still harping on about differences, differences of color and religion and faith and everything else? Why can't we see each other as a human race? Why do we want to go and feed the evil side of our nature instead of the other side? Because we know feeding the other side, what does it do? Death and destruction. Over and over again, history shows us that. Who are the winners? Even the people that are in power are only in power for a short period of time before their day comes. You know, surely it's time to change course.
Yes, I'm taking a little bit of a cynical tack here.
I know, it's very easy to be cynical when you look at the world. I'm just trying to be the optimist.
Yes, I know. Yes, you have to be. In fact, going back to that subject, between the wars, there were a lot of people who were pretty anti-war and their attitudes and their feeling. There was a great movie that came out. It was the Testament of Youth. And there was an anti-war kind of movement. It was based on a book, et cetera, et cetera. So the whole thing was there were people that were merchants of death. You're out there selling cannons. You're out there selling tanks. You're out selling arms and so on and so forth, making money off of war. These evil people who are merchants of death. Well, yeah, if we had been much better prepared, very well prepared in the 1930s, World War II might have been avoided, or it might have been handled much more easily, because we were, in the words of General Marshall, we were carrying the treasure and freedom of the United States in a paper bag, right, just way, way behind the curve. So if we had been better prepared, we could have avoided, quite possibly could have avoided World War II altogether. And then we look at the situation in China, and I'm sorry to say, but there's evil there. The business about allowing the disease to spread outside of China, outside of Wuhan, they could travel to Italy, they could travel around the world. If they spread around the world, they had to know what they were doing at the very least there. So we have to deal with a lot of evil, and we have to deal with it in a practical way. Strength gives us peace, even though there's kind of an irony there. The more guns we have, the more peace we have. Weakness invites attack. There's the old saying from Lenin, advance with bayonets. If you encounter mush, advance further. If you encounter steel, withdraw. So we have to be able to give steel to our enemies, or it would just, they'll run riot over us. They'll take advantage of us. They do not have they're so nice, we appreciate them. No. If they can cut our throats and they can dominate different parts of the world, they will. So it's through strength that we get peace. And that's kind of a bitter pill to swallow, but that is the reality we have to deal with.
I do feel that, you know, our entire way of thinking needs to change. You know, we're constantly on the defense. We're constantly, you know, bring it on. My gun's bigger than yours. And, you know, perhaps there was a wonderful saying the other day about communication is key, but how about compassionate communication? Actually speaking to one another to actually learn about one another instead of judge one another. And I think that perhaps the weapon now needs to be dialogue and not steel. And perhaps it needs to be about the depowering and more equalizing. And have we got a long way to go on that? Hell yes, we do. But I think it's rather stupid. You know, what's the Einstein thing about the thing of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting the same, different results. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we can look back at, you know, especially your book and showing all the blunders, showing all the what ifs. If this only had happened, if that had only happened, you know, where would we be today? And we change the course of that, maybe through stupidity, maybe through simple accidents, maybe through a different way of thinking, arrogance, ignorance, ego very much comes into play of all of that. But who would we have been today? Like China, a democracy, all those other wars not happening, you know, actually working together. Because what the hell are we here for on this planet? Just to kill each other off? I can't believe that. You know, and I think somewhere along the line, we have to learn. And if we can learn from looking at all the blunders that have happened, but the what ifs, is this now an invitation for us to look at, if only that paragraph had got in? If only that paragraph had got in, where would we be today for one paragraph? And if we can look at that and go, but why can't we revisit that paragraph now? Is it harder? Yes. But, you know, what angle can we take now to change the tide instead of just going for a swim?
Yes. Again, I'm going to, I want to live in the world that you're describing, but the world that we have, I think is, we have to say it's evil out there and we have to deal with evil. And if you, domination and the avoidance of domination are an important part and essential part or a critical part of human makeup. We all want to be significant. We all want to be free from domination. There are many people who aggrandize themselves through domination. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Putin, who is a murdering thug, mm-hmm. Talking with the president.
An egomaniac, narcissist, and all of that, yeah.
Right, and also President Xi, a nice, pleasant man in his terms of his manners and his demeanor, but is a murdering thug. The business about the soft approaches and let's be reasonable, let's be fair, let's be humane, doesn't mean anything to them. What they understand is strength. And if you have strength, they're willing to negotiate. If you have weaknesses, they're going to come by and they're going to choke you to death. And the example, back in 2014, when Putin invaded the Crimea without any resistance and began invading eastern Ukraine with limited resistance, and the that administration, I don't hate to get political, but that administration, the Obama administration, did very, very little. And they gave away the missile program. They took it on their missiles. They did very little. Also, when ISIL was starting to show its rear its ugly head, they were saying, oh, well, that's just a junior varsity team, just the JV team, not to worry. Well, okay, Putin conquers the Crimea. He attacks eastern Ukraine. The ISIL turns into this giant caliphate. When you give a soft side to your enemies, those kinds of people, they would just run rampant over you, which you have to do, which, by the way, to give credit to the current administration, they have communicated to Putin that we're going to do things now that we should have done in 2014 that we did not do. They're going to freeze the banking system so that they, if they were to invade Ukraine, so the Russians would, they would put a big clamp on the commerce going on in Russia, be damaging to their economy. They may not be buying the gas and oil, petroleum coming out of Russia. That would also be damaging to their economy. They're also going to give sophisticated and more advanced weapons to the Ukrainians who can defend themselves much better. The Javelin anti-tank missile and other sophisticated weapons. So it's going to be a very painful and difficult experience if he goes down that road. If you give him a lot of pain, you attach a lot of pain that decision, he may choose not to do it. My guess is, and I don't know, he will not invade, but I don't know. Same thing with China. Of course, they're looking at Taiwan and they're making serious threats about invading Taiwan. Well, you need to make that extremely painful also in terms of the military defense that Taiwan can provide, also the economic penalties that will go with it. Yet if the is another basic thing that human beings, everything we do in life is done for one of two reasons, okay? Either to avoid pain or to seek pleasure. And of those two, avoiding pain is the most important, is the most powerful. Sorry to say that, but it is. So anyway, if you make it very painful, make it clear it's gonna be a very painful choice to invade Taiwan or a very painful choice to invade Ukraine, that's what will change their mind. The fact that the goodness of humanity would be best served if they didn't, doesn't mean much to those people.
No, but I think you can blend the two. You know, you can have the force behind you. But, you know, I know that the younger generation just don't want to continue down the same path, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking at, I was watching something yesterday with, you know, how much China has bought up Africa. And was it a particular African country where they had borrowed money to improve their airport and they're now recalling their loan and saying, mm-hmm. otherwise we're going to take over your airport. Mm-hmm. And there's a few billionaires that spend a few billion at a time to go up into space for 11 minutes. How about you buy all of that up, pay Russia back, take away their power over Africa, and actually look at Africa and say, how can we build you as a nation that you are a force to be reckoned with on your own, that you aren't vulnerable to the leeches?
Yes, we should be countering the moves on China with exactly
the chess play? You know, instead of just the gun war, where's the chess play?
Yes, and one thing that's it's Evergrande, I think, is the name of the very large real estate organization that is in default. It's in a kind of a bankruptcy, and the economy in China is faltering. Some people say it makes them more dangerous because they are having weakness now, but they're not the threat they seem to be. In one sense, they're not the threat they seem to be 5 or 10 years ago because their economy is stumbling. But at the same time, they may be more feel like a cornered animal. They may feel the need to strike out more than that kind of circumstance. So, but that it is, of course, Henry Kissinger and the other diplomats over the years have been successful in many cases. The fact that we had nuclear weapons as a counterbalance to any kind of Russian attack. The Russians could have overrun Western Europe easily, except for atomic weapons that was kept them in check. And we had peace in Europe for over 40 years. So that kind of balance of power, and like you say, very good diplomacy and very good strategizing can keep us in peace and keep the enemy at bay. And hopefully those areas of the world that are suffering economically and politically from a lack of individual freedom, Latin America, much of Latin America, Africa, much of Asia, maybe they can start moving in the right direction. It looked like democracy was on the upswing several years ago. Now it seems like Russia going back the other way, China going the other way. It seems like it's kind of receding, but maybe there can be a movement towards democracy and prosperity. And I'm a believer in free enterprise, and the rest of the world can become prosperous and not just certain countries and
not the dominance, you know, it's Western like, you know, as a mother, you know, the mother instincts come out of me, and it's like the reprimand, the voice comes out, the mama voice comes out, and they already know, uh-oh, we're in trouble, right? And it's like, show the wooden spoon, you don't need to use it. You've already scared them shitless, right? And it's so, now we're going to talk about that. And I think, yeah, your weapons can be the wooden spoon, but there has to be the dialogue. There has to be the dialogue, you know?
Yes, absolutely right. That's exactly right. If you have the weapons, you have the strength, and they know you have the strength, then they're willing to negotiate. If they think you're weak and they don't have to negotiate, well, they just take it, then they will take it. And you, what you say brings up an interesting point. It was some of the jockeys would say in working with the racehorses, they wouldn't sometimes not use the whip, but they would walk around and make sure that the horse saw the whip.
Yes, yes.
Of course, it depends on the horse. Some of the horses respond to the whip well. Some rebel when they whip. But if they certain horses, if they just know you have the whip, they see the whip. Yep. Somehow that is the right way to approach.
So the
that
deterrent, would be the, right?
The show the whip approach, and then maybe you don't have to use it, kind of thing. So
it's the same thing that, you know, China and Russia are using on the intimidation of everything else. We've got weapons, you haven't, so we can intimidate, right? So as you said, by giving those that are suppressed, the access to weapons or to force in some kind, you know, some upper hand, you know, then it's a more of an even table when it comes to it. But it's, you know, that it is like the piranhas. If they see somebody weak, I'm going to just gobble them up. Well, how about we take all the weak nations and strengthen them, right? And then they don't become so vulnerable. And I just think, you know, going back to that paragraph of more the equality around the world, I think that we would actually realize with, you know, all countries, all human races having more equality, we would be more of an enriched human nation with so much more e-commerce and abundance in the world. But this constant hierarchy and bullying and I've got to have the power, you know, is really, it's been the detriment of humanity from the beginning of time, and it always will be until we get our act together.
Well, yes, now, of course, it's a complicated situation. For example, of course, in the case of Mexico, for example, the drugs and the drug cartels, because the United States is spilling, individuals in the United States willing to spend billions of dollars to get those drugs, the fentanyl and the rest of it like that. That huge market has created very powerful cartels who then have just virtually taken over Mexico, and the justice system is just pretty much in collapse. So how does Mexico, if you're trying to be president of Mexico, you probably can't get there unless you are at the beck and call of the drug cartels. And how do you solve that problem? It's a very difficult problem to solve. Also in Central America, the same thing. It's a very difficult thing, and going in and getting involved in nation building is extremely right. challenging and not very rewarding. So it's a I don't have the solutions to all of our problems. Too bad Latin America cannot become a more just, balanced, democratic, and prospering area. Too bad Africa, which is I guess the saddest in some ways, the saddest place in the world, some of the most the greatest yeah. poverty, as well as the Middle East and so on like that. I don't have solutions for that. If there was a higher level of education and prosperity, there's a better chance of having a higher level of functioning democracy and freedom and protection for individuals. How we get from here to there is going to be a huge challenge. Hopefully in the next 50 years or 100 years, yeah. we can move down that road and have some fruitful results, we hope.
Yeah. Everything is e-commerce. You know, supply and demand. If we stop demanding, the supply dries up, right? Mm-hmm. Or if we, the old boycotting, but if it's like, if we don't buy from China, right? If we don't buy the drugs, folks, you know, it's, yes, it looks simple, but somewhere along the line, it's attack the source, not just the Band-Aid, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, I go back to that one paragraph, over that one paragraph, how life would have been different. And, you know, it's, we have this opportunity right now. Yeah, okay, 45% evil, 55% not. Well, it's still 55%. So how do we tilt the scales? And we have to have some optimism. And we also have to have some sensibility. And just, you know, it's not about strutting the stuff. My gun's bigger than yours. Boo, I'm a bigger bully. It's about, why are you feeling that you need to have this power? What if there is an actual solution there that your country could be highly economical? And therefore, the power would be on you with providing for your people instead of intimidating for your people. I just don't understand why things are not looked at differently. And instead, it's always got to be, you know, one gobbling up the other. And so, you know, I mean, do we not learn from history? You've got it all through your book. Do we not learn?
yes, I think, and I hate to sound overly cynical, but I think we have to have strength. If you have strength, and you can go into the negotiating table. You have strength, you can apply different kinds of pressure, and things can move in the right direction. If you have the attitude that we have a humane philosophy here, we want to have understanding, we want to have support of underdeveloped people, people in need, and downtrodden people, and so on and so forth. Doesn't mean anything to the evil forces and the leaders of those countries that are leading those evil forces. It means nothing to them. What mm-hmm. they understand, I know it's an old cliche, yeah. and it sounds hard and bitter, but they understand strength. Strength they will respond to, they'll negotiate. You can work with them if you're coming from a position of strength. Coming from a position of weakness, it's a little bit like the lamb trying to negotiate with the wolf.
Yeah. Show them the whip, show them the wooden spoon, show them the strength, yeah. and just say, your tactics have to change.
Yes, if you have the whip, if you have the strength, okay, then you can make progress.
But that's what I'm saying, you can have it there. It's mm-hmm. just, don't go meet the weapons and have them solve it out. It's like, here is the whip, and I'm prepared to use it. You know, mm-hmm. this whip, this wooden spoon is prepared to come out, but mm-hmm. this is to bring you to the table where things have got to change. It's just the perpetual wars. You know, mm-hmm. and it's like, where is that getting us? Death, 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 and more hate and destruction. So surely we've got to change the record, right?
Yes, yeah, that balance of having a strong and being able to respond, which I give credit to the current administration. They're doing what they did not do. The previous Democratic administration did not do in 2014. They are moving with a lot of criticism for not having moved sooner. They are applying some strength and pressure, which may very well work in this situation with Putin and possibly Taiwan. We'll see. Now, by the way, on that subject, associated over there, there were two wars that I think in the United States could have avoided these last 60 years, two wars that did not have to take place.
Vietnam.
That was Vietnam, number one, and then also the war in Iraq did not have to take place.
Yes. Yeah.
So, and I'm from Texas. I'll make a point here. I'm from Texas, and I volunteered for the Vietnam War and volunteered for the infantry and whole thing, in part because of the heritage of the Alamo.
Yeah.
and the whole business. I mean, seriously, there's something about Texans and war. But anyway, we had a Texas president at the beginning of the Vietnam War, and we had a Texas president at the beginning of the war in Iraq. In both cases, I think if we'd had a Texan, I mean, not Texan, but if we had a president who was from Vermont or Connecticut or Wisconsin or something like that, they might, or it come down from Canada. But we can't do that because the Constitution. But anyway, but if we had someone with a little bit less of a bellicose attitude,
right.
It could have been avoided. There was a recorded conversation between Lyndon Johnson and Robert McNamara. The recording exists today. And he was saying to them, talking about Vietnam, I want you to have some people put a plan together. We'll go over there and whip the hell out of them. Okay, well, that's the kind of thing that a Texan would say, okay?
Yes.
And then, of course, then...
Hi, Carl.
That kind of thing. And then also the thing about Iraq that... in fact, let me bring up one of the items in the book, which I think is important. And that one is... We talked about the election of 2000 election, didn't we?
We did.
But anyway, yes, again, that war, Al Gore, to his credit, I'm not necessarily a big fan of Al Gore. It could have been avoided altogether. It was not necessary. It turned out it was a hollow threat. Saddam may have been giving the impression to his neighbors that he had nuclear weapons or a nuclear weapon program they didn't really have, so they'd be more
intimidated. He was strutting his stuff, right?
Yeah. So on like that. So anyway, it could have been avoided. And there were those people, Al Gore and others, who were saying, you're going too far. And so but if it had been a person with a different mentality against somebody from Wisconsin, it could have been, those two wars could have been avoided. We went a little bit too far and supposedly defending ourselves and to the point that we were kind of more aggressive than we had to be.
Right. And, you know, that's something that one has to check in as a nation. You know, do we glorify war too much that, oh, yeah, let's go and get them, you know, and be the hero. And, you know, perhaps if we didn't kind of heroize it so much, you know, in our movies and in our approach and realize there's death at the end of that for somebody. There's, you know, despair with families losing people. There's the economic situation, repercussion of it. Maybe we wouldn't be so fast to just push the trigger, you know? And so there's a lot to be thought of there. Your book raises so many questions, and it's really quite fascinating just, you know, for one mistake, you know, how the world would have been so different. And, you know, as intriguing as it is to read that and go, oh, really, really? I still think it's food for thought for us in moving forward. And like, let us be more mindful of our own actions now so we don't make those silly little mistakes that now can trigger something in our own personal lives, in all aspects of life. Because it's entertaining, your book, it's intriguing, your book, but at the same time, let it be food for thought.
Yes, well, here's two. Now, there's a practical thing coming at it from a purely practical aspect. There's a book out there that has saved more lives and continues to save more lives than any other book in history. And it's the book, The Checklist Manifesto. Again, this is from a purely practical aspect. And a gentleman named Atul Gawande wrote the book. He was a surgeon, and he was looking at the situation in the operating room. He was saying the way it works, or what it used to work, is that if you get 6 or 7 or 8 years experience underneath your belt, you go into the operating room and you just go on gut instinct based on your experience. He said, well, yes, but we're human. We miss things. Well, is there some better system that we can avoid these mistakes that are taking place and so that the survival rate is much, much higher than it's been? I wonder how they do this over in the airline industry. They also deal with great complexity with short amounts of time where decisions have to be made quickly. Wonder how they have handled it. So he went over there and talked to the people at Boeing, and it went back to a famous airline crash that took place way back in 1935. And it was the forerunner of the Flying Fortress that was being tested by the pilots at Boeing. And it was an accident that killed both the pilot and the co-pilot. They did the accident investigation, and the source of the problem was a simple thing. They forgot to turn off the elevator yoke, which caused the airplane to go up in the air. Shortly after takeoff, it stalled and it pancaked down, and then both the pilot and the co-pilot were killed. Just a simple switch that was not thrown that should have been thrown. So they came up with a solution, a simple, an ancient tool, the humble checklist. And what they would do now, they put this together as a checklist to say 37 items or 43 items, and a co-pilot and pilot go through it. We turn this dial to this position, check, check. We turn off the elevator yoke.
Yeah.
We turn over this one, check, check. And all these 37 items or 43 items are gone through, double check with both the pilot and the co-pilot, and that avoided a lot of mistakes. And of course, going into World War II, which came along just several years later, with a lot of novice pilots with very little flying experience, it saved hundreds and maybe thousands of lives. Okay, Atul Gawande said, let's take that and we'll apply it to the operating room. And again, we're talking about a simple basic program, the checklist. And of course, now it's a accepted practice. They go through before operation begins of a detailed checklist and other procedures, a checklist to make sure all 17 items, 23 items, 45 items are checked off and reviewed. Human beings can only think about one thing at a time. And you have to make sure that you're going to think about all those 37 items, those 43 items, none of them gets left behind. So anyway, and also they learned, by the way, that when the people in the operating room, everybody knew each other's name. That was also very helpful because it encouraged communication, and better communication also avoided mistakes. Right. And they got very good results, incredibly good results. The fatality rates when this program was applied dropped 36%, 36% of people surviving than would have died otherwise. Mm-hmm. So it is a program that has been wisely applied. It can apply to everything in our lives.
Absolutely.
Building a bird's nest, putting together a garden in the backyard. You have a checklist. You go down the checklist very carefully. And also I talk in the book about this, as a pilot of World War II, it was Dusty Kloss was his name, and talking about what detailed preparation he put together before he got into the cockpit to fly against into war, a series of items that he had done to make sure he has the two kinds of wool cloths to wipe off the windshield, make sure he has the right kinds of wax pencils, has two wax pencils in case one of them fails, et cetera, et cetera. A big emphasis, just like the Boy Scouts, be prepared. That also can avoid a lot of small mistakes. Now that doesn't touch on the bigger philosophy or philosophical questions about avoiding some wars, and it doesn't mean avoid some wars, but you may be more successful in the war.
You're right.
Also, if you're on the operating table, you may be more successful in saving people's lives if you have that kind of detailed preparation and also detailed follow through to make sure all the details are taken care of, because the devil is indeed in the details.
Yes. I mean, you don't go and put the roof on first.
Right.
You know, so, you know, that there is always levels to things, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 steps. And it's the more you actually know what those steps are, as you say, you can check it off. We've done that one. That's fine. What's next? Okay, we've done that. And you know, if you apply that to every aspect of your life, then that means that you're in a direction, the stitch in time. You know that you're on the right road. And it's like you come across one and go, okay, this is a problem. It's not the whole thing is a problem. This one step is an issue, and it's easier to direct in it because you're not feeling overwhelmed by everything. So yeah, just two people's lives sacrificed saved millions and millions of people, or more than that.
Yeah, there was an important lesson learned there that changed the entire airline industry and then changed the medical field as well.
And that's the thing, let's learn from the mistakes. You know, the failure is in not learning. Right. It is not a failure to fall on your backside and, you know, and get back up and do it a different way. That's the lesson. The failure is to sit on the backside and go, OK, it can't be done any other way. I'm not going to do it. So, you know, I think that anytime we have a mistake like that, it's a mistake that we learn from. So therefore, it's not a failure.
Yes. And it's funny how people can. They govern their lives through their core beliefs, and sometimes they'll express their core belief in a metaphor or an actual statement. And that subject, Bill Clinton had, and whether you like him or dislike him, he had the core belief that you can sometimes win by never quitting. And sometimes even when he got knocked down flat, he kept coming, come back, kept going.
Like a bouncy thing.
And that's right, kept coming back, and was successful with a great deal of determination and persistence. And so then that's a thing. And then Hitler, by the way, speaking of, he had a core belief which was not quite so positive, and that was the world belongs to the brave. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think he won the Iron Cross 2 different times. He was very brave. He's also very evil. He's also very twisted. He's also very sick. He caused great, great harm to Germany, great harm to the world. So if he had a different core belief,
right,
then maybe he had the bravery balance.
Who is that core belief serving? Right. Yeah, that's the question. Yeah.
And he, of course, it was, in the end, it was very self-destructive for him also. Another good core belief, George Bush, the father, had the core belief that good things happen to good people. That's a good one right there, because if you're good to people, nice to people. And he was, by the way, whether you're Republican or Democrat, everybody agrees. What a wonderful, wonderful man he was. Yeah. He and Barbara, the people that worked there at the White House, he knew about their children, he knew their children's name. When he would see them, how is Barbara doing? How is John doing? He was a very considerate, thoughtful man, and good things came to him as a result of that.
Right.
That's the kind of core belief that we want more of in the world, and less of the other one. So,
well, what we feed is what grows, right?
Mm-hmm, so,
you know, seed, you know, right, the right seeds, water and nurture them. And, you know, it's rather, you know, social media is an algorithm, it gets a bad rap, but if you're getting negativity from it, just because that's what you're feeding or responding to. So if you choose to feed, you know, the options of, you know, more upbeat, more positive, more solutional, then that is what's going to grow. And I think if we could keep that in our minds, in our lives, is that you don't like where this is going, it's up to you to change. The change is always within you. How you see it, how you speak it, how you do it. Right. So we can change our own algorithm. And I think that a lot of it just comes from our own perception and our own why. Right.
Yes. The guru, the kind of motivational speaker, Tony Robbins, has a thing. He talks about how people tend to get, all of us tend to get what we emphasize. That thing which you emphasize, that's what tends to come back. If you're working very, very hard at your job and very thoughtful and very considerate, a lot of times it will work out well as a result. Yeah. If you're emphasizing a good relationship with your family and your friends, you look, how can we make this better? How can we make this work? You tend to get that. If you are thinking about how can I feel good in the next 30 minutes, okay, you take whatever stamina or depressant make you feel good in 30 minutes. Okay, well, 2 hours and 5 hours, and the next day you're going to feel like crap.
Right.
Okay, I mean, so you don't want to trade, do not want to trade short-term gratification for long-term gratification.
Right.
But you know, the things that we think of as our biggest priorities, that we give the biggest emphasis to, that tends to be what you will get. And so think of what you're emphasizing, what you are thinking of as a high priority, and then that's where you're taking your life. And is that where you want to be in 1 year, 3 years, 5 years?
Right. I think this book should be in every home. I think it's a book that, you know, teenagers up, that should be read by the family, you know, and because not only is, wow, really? Oh my God, imagine, you know, I still feel that it is planting the seed for redirections in their own lives, or seeing it, God, I don't want to make that mistake, you know. And I think the more you become aware of mistakes, the costly mistakes that have been, perhaps you become more aware of your own decision making, you know, to avoid those mistakes in the beginning. So I think this is a household book that not only can be entertaining and intriguing, but at the same time plant those seeds of, you know, of more awareness, more attunement, and, you know, more of that perception of how a silly mistake even in your own life can change, you know, everything. And I think it's you know, as it's intriguing, yes, really, what there's a lot of what's in there, but at the same time, food for thought. And, you know, you're planting seeds in there of like, be mindful. Be mindful and be aware, and you know, oh, for that one paragraph, how life would have been different.
Yeah,
and I think it can help people kind of look forward into their own decision making in their own lives. And as I say, read it as a family. You know, it's then I think it can be something that can really be brought together and start a conversation. And quite obviously, that's what we want, isn't it? We want people conversing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can do it over that book. Well, what if, and what if, and what if, oh gosh, can you imagine if it had been that? And get the conversation going. I think it should be in schools, most certainly. Yep.
I think so. Yeah, I think young people in particular, learning about careful preparation, about careful follow through, that's an important thing in your career, in school, in your career, at whatever you choose to go into, whether it's a medical field or whether it's an engineering field or just in business. It's very important because those details can really, really bite you. Would you like another one? Would you like another one?
That's
kind of
yes.
So anyway, this one is actually the very first one I thought of way back 11 years when I first had the idea. And that was, this teaser is that a single piece of tape rotated several inches the wrong direction changed the outcome of the Vietnam War. The United States might very well have won except for this single tiny mistake, which doesn't make any sense, does it?
No, not at all. More.
yes. It has to do with the Watergate break-in. When the burglars were breaking, jimmying the lock from the parking garage into the office building, they were told to hold the striker on the door down with a piece of tape placed in the vertical position to hold the striker down. They made a mistake. They put the tape in the horizontal position. They should listen to instruction.
Right.
Okay, the problem there is with them is that when Frank Wills came walking down the hallway as a night watchman doing his job, and he sees tape on the door face, which he would not have seen if it had been in the vertical position, or they put a plug in the receiver. He sees it, but what's the tape? What is it? Wait a minute, the tape, the door's been jimmied here. So he calls the police, the Washington D.C. police, and he had to call them twice, by the way, so they calls them. And then they called, the rumor is that they contacted the local uniform officer who was in charge of that area to go out and check it out. But there's a strong rumor indicating that the officer was intoxicated in a local bar and could not respond. So they had to send the bum patrol, as three officers dressed as hobos in a jalopy car. Okay, they have to go instead. Well, they pull up to the Watergate complex. The lookout does not recognize them as police officers. He does not tell the burglars inside to get out of there in a hurry. They go in there. They arrest James McCord. They arrest and also the burglars. By the way, you see the tape I'm talking about in the movie. And it's Frank Wills plays himself in that movie. Anyway, so they arrest James McCord and the burglars. Watergate begins. Boom, 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 boom. And Henry Kissinger gave an interview sometime later talking about how the plan was. They knew that the North Vietnamese were going to be testing the treaty. And the plan was to go back in there and bomb the living daylights out of them again to get them back in compliance, okay, with the treaty. But they were so weak politically, they could not. So South Vietnam collapses, Nixon administration collapses, it all falls apart because of a single piece of tape turned several inches the wrong direction and a drunk cop.
You see? I mean, just fascinating.
Yes.
Fascinating.
So the lesson, one lesson there is don't drink on the job, I guess.
Right.
Yes,
and the other one is pay attention to the directions.
Instructions like that, because a single mistake can really come back and rip you a new one.
And you know, the other thing is the persistence of the security guard. He could have just shrugged his shoulder. I've reported it. Nobody's coming.
Call twice. That's right. Call twice.
So a lot to be learned there. A hell of a lot to be learned there. And, you know, again, you never know, you know, what you are uncovering, really what the repercussions are. Right? So it's, that's a great story to end the show with. So thank you so much. How do people get this book? I know that this is the week of Christmas. This has been aired, but you know, it doesn't have to be a Christmas present. How about starting off 2022 with this book in hand and kind of make it, you know, that family book of conversation, right? Because I really do think, I mean, silly things like that, that one story, how you could really look at it even as a parallel in your own life and look at the what ifs, because a hell of a lot of this is what if it had been done differently, you know?
Yes. But yes, to answer your question, yes, you can go to tinyblundersbigdisasters.com. tinyblundersbigdisasters.com. That takes you to my website. We have 2.5 free chapters there. We also have a great book trailer there. We have a portrait gallery, which is one of my favorite parts of the book. Mm-hmm. And you can look that over. There's also an 18-minute radio interview there. You can listen to that. And then, of course, you can order. And we have a special this week. The electronic download is just $1.99 for this week. Of course, you can order the paperback book, which makes it great to give it. It arrives in just 2 or 3 days, by the way, for Amazon. So you can make it a great gift either for Christmas or after Christmas for an uncle or grandfather or father who loves history, or as well as a grandmother and an aunt who loves history. And it makes a great gift. And we'd appreciate it very much.
Yeah, I think it's great. So also on Amazon, folks. So, you know, come over there and buy it directly from there. You know, the thing is, again, I just say it, schools, I think it is essential.
Yes.
In the homes, I think it's a great conversation piece, but at the same time, it's a wonderful lesson, you know, and what can be learnt from this, you know, and at the same time, as you said, people who just kind of love history, you know, because the effect that it's had on our present and on our future. Well, not our future. Our future is still up to us, but on our present, you know, I think it is absolutely intriguing. So I'm glad that you have dedicated your 11 years to this, in writing this. I'm just fascinating in how you even managed to get all this material and how you found it all, because you had to dug up a few rocks to do it.
Yes. It was fun writing it, a lot of fun, talking to people about it. And it makes me feel very good. I talked to a lot of people, say they really enjoyed the book. We have terrific, excellent reviews there. It makes me feel very good on the inside. So it's fun all the way through.
Right. And you know, something that you've loved doing and love the response of. But I really do see this book living long beyond, just because of the lessons that are there, the, you know, the whole intrigue. But, you know, at the same time, is that the more hindsight we look at things, I think the better decision making we can make moving forward.
Yes, you're wiser for it. Absolutely.
Right. Wisdom is always in the past.
Yes, right. And the book is a lot of fun. I will say that. The book is a lot of fun as well. So there's some wisdom to be acquired there, but also it's a heck of a lot of fun to read, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, for the paragraph, a piece of sticky tape. Right, I mean, you know, the helmet coming off the wall. I mean, all of these things, you know, it just, it's like, you know, oh my God. And if it can make you more mindful in putting a document together, then great.
Sure, right? Absolutely. A better person for it, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So much to be learned from here. Thank you so much for coming and sharing with us today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate it.
So, tinyblundersbigdisasters.com.
Yes, ma'am.
Excellent. And and it's on Amazon, folks. And whether Christmas has gone or not, when you listen to this show, this is a book you need to get. Share with people. Have a book club. Wow, how fascinating. You all read a chapter and you come back and you go, and just the conversations it can spark.
Great conversations.
Yeah,
great conversations.
I mean, you know, we've all got tiny blunders.
That's right. I wish I could say I did. Absolutely. Right.
And so, you know, it can spark some very interesting conversations. So this is a book that keeps on giving. So thank you so much, Jared. I mean, absolutely wonderful having you here. And to everyone else, remember, those little faux pas can be very, very costly. Learn from your past to apply to your future. Until next time, bye for now.
Thank you so much.
We hope that you enjoyed the show. You will hear many, many shows here on softdiscoverymedia.com. We have new shows for you out every week. Just find them on our podcast or What's New. If you feel that you have something to share that makes a difference in the lives of others, or you too feel that you could be a host, please contact me at info@selfdiscoverymedia.com, and we will be glad to speak with you. Have a wonderful day.